Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 if you're in Points East along the Columbia River Gorge. In Corvallis and Albany, it's 100.7. On the World Wide Web, it's KBOO.FM. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, everybody out there, good morning. And welcome to More Talk Radio. I'm here with my co-host,
Cecil.
Okay.
That's God.
All right. I was going to say, tell them all of who you are. You know, today we bask in our moment. It's a little cloudy outside, but inside it's blazing. You know, it's very bright. And if you've been fortunate enough to hear the announcement, you know, we also have an esteemed guest here with us today, bringing more light.
Thank you.
Much more illumination. We're here with Yvelle Louise Gordley. How do you sum up the up to this point accomplishments of a homegrown star, a beacon, someone who has set the bar high and insisted on trying to reach that bar herself, not necessarily overtly telling anybody else this is the standard, just saying this is where I want to go. And in doing so, looking to satisfy the needs of the community, looking at trying to remember the people, serve the people. Louise Gordley, more commonly known as Yvelle, who has even said, don't call me Ms. Gordley, call me Yvelle, a person who embodies servant leadership. Welcome. I'm honored to have you here. I have run across you so many different places and times since I've been here in Portland, and it only seems fitting that one of the places that I settled to do my contribution to the community and giving back, I would have the pleasure of having you here. So, you know, it makes it feel like really a full circle adventure.
It's a pleasure to be with you and my friend Cecil.
And thank you so much for joining with us this morning. And we want to tell our listeners that one reason that we have you here is because you recently authored your memoir entitled Remembering the Power of Words, The Life of an Oregon Activist, Legislator, and Community Leader.
And go ahead.
No, it's published by Oregon State University Press.
Yes, yes.
And it's a timely offering. There are so many different disparate and discouraging threads that are being woven into our state tapestry right now. Not only are we dealing with deficits in terms of how we're going to fund a lot of our human services, mm-hmm. but we're dealing with the fallout of decades ago of poor planning.
Yes.
Of not using foresight to build us up and give us not only a new wave in terms of education for our young people who were then in our elementary school systems, but in terms of understanding what kinds of workforce we would need. And one of the things that you have done is champion education.
Mm-hmm.
And look toward the future, and look toward the future not only in trying to find ways to address our budget issues, which would be your more recent contributions mm-hmm. in our state legislature, but also in your earliest work, look at what are the challenges that were faced not only by the Black community, but students at large here
mm-hmm.
in Oregon in terms of looking for an equitable, non-racist education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In doing so, I think you've pointed the path. You've pointed the direction. It might have been a circular fashion, but you pointed the direction coming out of your youth, coming out of your beginnings. The things that you talked about that were not only fundamental to your education, but fundamental to your development began when you were really young here in the community.
Yes, yes.
So just paint a little picture for us of who Yvelle Louise was.
Well,
Again, I want to thank both of you, Celeste and Cecil, for this opportunity to share a little bit more about the memoir. And I must start by also acknowledging my colleague at Portland State University, Dr. Patricia Schechter. Patricia is a member of the History Department, and it was through her assistance working with me for over 22 hours of taped interviews that we put together this a manuscript that then became what you have in front of you now, the memoir. There's more I could say about our process, but again, I'm just so very grateful to Patricia for working with me to produce the memoir. And I also want to note that she drew on my papers, which I gifted to Portland State University, jointly to the Portland State University Library and the Black Studies Department a few years ago. So if you go to the Portland State Library, you can go up to the fifth floor, and there's a little room up there that has the Gordley collection. And that collection is available to students. It's available to the community. It's an opportunity to study a life of activism going back to about 1978-79. I am a product of this community, an Oregon native, in that my parents... Well, starting on my mother's side, my mother and her family came out to Oregon from Alabama in Texas in the 1920s. And then later, my father, Faye Gordley, and his mother, Lessie, came to Portland in 1936 from Texas, San Antonio, Texas. And at that time, on the part of both families, they were part of that historic black migration that saw black folks leaving the South and moving north into other places in the country, seeking job opportunities, seeking a better life. My father found work on the railroad. Union Pacific Railroad, where he worked for over 40 years until he retired in the early 70s. My grandmother, my paternal grandmother, worked in the shipyards, the Kaiser shipyards. And then on my mother's side, there was domestic work, meaning working in the homes of wealthy whites doing domestic work, and my mother also later worked part-time in a grocery store. It happened to be a grocery store owned by an African-American man, Bill Benton, no longer living, but that's another story that needs to also be documented, and I hope someone will do that. All of these words to say that, again, I'm a product of Oregon, Portland, born and raised in this community, two-parent, working-class family, hard-working family, came up at a time when there was a close-knit black community in Portland. Our family home was at North Williams Avenue, and North Williams Avenue between Going and Skidmore. And it was a time when, as I said, it was close-knit. We went to church on Sunday. Our parents, all of our parents during that time, were very dedicated to making sure that we received an education, a good education. They wanted our lives to be better than what they had better than what they had experienced. So, and what I experienced was that my parents and grandparents and the surrounding community, these were all folks who poured everything they had into me and just all of the young ones coming along at that time.
We're speaking this morning with Senator Avell Gordley, who recently wrote her memoirs, Remembering the Power of Words. As we continue our conversation, Senator Gordley, I listen to you reflect upon growing up in a close-knit community, one thing that we are aware of is the importance of community in this time where there are so many dispersed voices. I'm wondering if you could paint a picture what it was like to grow up in a community where I imagine responsibility was not only within the household, but among other people. You mentioned going to church, you haven't yet mentioned in terms of schooling. What was it like growing up in Portland in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s?
Well, church was very important every Sunday morning. I was raised in Mount Olivet Baptist Church, both my sister and I. My mom, my dad attended rarely, I'll say that, but because it had a lot to do with the fact that he was a railroad man, mm-hmm. and so he was gone away from home 3 days and then home for another couple of days and then gone again. But he would definitely have claimed membership in Mount Olivet Baptist Church, and the church is where we got our training. We young people got our training. I mean, there were the youth organizations. That's where we got our first speaking opportunities, speak before our peers, speak before the congregation. That's where we found our affirmation. And that's also where we heard a lot about the importance of striving, toward education. And then my mother and grandmothers, both grandmothers, were very active in, as I said, church, but then also women's clubs. They were part of the club movement. In Oregon, we have what is called the Oregon Association of Colored Women's Clubs, and it's part of the national movement, the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. My grandmother, Alberta Louise Randolph, maternal grandmother, was a founder of the Harriet Tubman Club back in the 1920s, again coming to Oregon. And that club was a group of black women who came together to study together. They were very literate. They had a love of reading, but they were also called themselves together for social uplift and the uplift of the community. In fact, the motto of the Association of Colored Women's Clubs is lifting as we climb, lifting as we climb. So that's what I saw as I was growing up. I saw these amazing women. Let me back up. My mother would take my sister and I to all the teas, all the church gatherings, all the different club women events. So we grew up seeing women in charge of the world, so we thought. Mm-hmm. And there were always women in and out of our home, again, different meetings. That was something that I grew up with, and it just seemed as normal as breathing. Another standout memory for me is the grocery store on the corner of Going and Williams, Maxie's Better Buy Grocery. And the owners were Mr. and Mrs. Maxie. Mr. Maxie is no longer living. Mrs. Maxie is now in her 90s, I believe. She is in her 90s. They, as we kids would be coming home from grade school, walking home from what was then Highland Grade School. It later became Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School. But as we would walk home and pass by the grocery store or go into the grocery store to get candy or whatever, we could always count on Mr. or Mrs. Maxey asking us, how are things going? You know, how was school today? And you could not just say, fine. You knew that they were going to probe. They really wanted to know how we were doing in school and how we were doing around the neighborhood. And it was like that with most, if not all, of the adults at that time. They all had a hand on you. And you knew that you were, we all knew that we were accountable to the adults, all the adults in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really important that we want to kind of lay the foundation for was the strength that gathered from the community that launched a generation of community leaders. One of the things that I heard you talking about were some important markers of place. Mm-hmm. And Cecil, you even alluded to that when you talk about the diffused voices of community. Thinking back to your development as a community leader, how important was that sense of place? Because if you contrast it to where we are now, there are a generation of Black Portlanders who are not growing up with that sense of place. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it could, in some ways, diffuse the idea of how you serve. There's nothing wrong with serving everybody, mm-hmm. and you made a point of saying that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of gathering that strength that's so critical to moving the needs of the community forward, how important was that sense of place?
You just really struck a very important chord. Again, drawing on my memories of growing up on North Williams Avenue, south of our home, going toward Broadway, you had homes, but you also had businesses, beauty shops, barber shops, you know, ice cream store, cleaners, mm-hmm. Newspaper, office, clubs, just a whole range of businesses that served the needs of the Black community at that time. And that was true along North Williams Avenue as well as Russell Street. That was a very important intersection. Again, a whole row of other businesses along Russell Street. So there was community. And community inclusive of people who were building community through home ownership, building community through their membership at the various churches that served the community, building community through the various business enterprises that existed at the time. And I contrast that to now when just recently, and I was sharing this with the group the other day, when I drive north now on Williams Avenue coming from Broadway, it is with, I experience pain. I experience pain and loss. And I will also say that there is some anger there. As I see all the different businesses that have that are just popping up, mm-hmm. like almost overnight, the result of investment, development, the result of public policy that has made the area open and attractive for all this new business development, and the loss and pain I feel is associated with knowing what was there before. That something was removed in order for this something new some decades later to take root. And the pain I feel and the sense of loss is around, I don't want our story to be lost. I'm very, very conscious of the fact that public policy makers made decisions that resulted in the uprooting, the dispersal, the removal of the community that I grew up with in the 50s and 60s. And by public policy, I mean, the siting of the freeway, the siting of
the Coliseum.
Thank you, Cecil. Mm-hmm. Emmanuel Hospital and, you know, taking out all those houses and the land that just sat there, that vacant sore that just sat there for all those years. And now I guess it's going to be a parking lot or something. So there's pain and loss. And at the same time, I just think it's so important that those of us who did grow up here during that time, that we put our stories down, that we capture that information so that we can pass it on, so that we can make it plain that we did and do have a legacy in this town. It's so important for young people to know that. When I think of folks like Tony Hobson, who grew up here, Lorenzo Poe, Ray Leary, some folks who have roots here, who grew up and became public servants, major contributors, community builders, pardon me, I hope that they will put their stories down as well, so that the young people coming along will know how we invented ourselves, mm-hmm. and they'll know what shoulders we were standing on as we tried to do the things that were right and just and fair, the things that we were taught to do by our parents and through church and through the other folks who helped raise us in community. I hope that's making sense.
Indeed. We're speaking this morning with Avell Louise Gordley, who recently authored her memoirs with Patricia Schechter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's entitled Remembering the Power of Words, The Life of an Oregon Activist, Legislator, and Community Leader. One caller called, wanted to know where she may get a copy of your book.
Oh, thank you very much. It's available at Broadway Books. It's available at Powell's, at Talking Drum Reflections, at Barnes & Noble, and the PSU Bookstore. Those are a few places I'm aware of.
Excellent.
Thank you.
We have another caller who wants to, Michael would like to speak with you. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Come on, guest. As a black man, I'm really disappointed in Obama because he's acting like a warmonger like Bush did. Now he's attacking and trying to kill our brother Gaddafi. And I just, I want to know what the guest's thought on is. And that looks like now we've got a warmonger in here who wants to start up the war machine again. Well, what's up with that?
Thank you for your call.
Well, it's a complicated issue, very complicated issue. And I would invite the caller to do a couple of things. One, revisit Obama's, the two books that he wrote, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams of My Father. Go back and revisit his words about what it is, where he describes the forces that shaped him and shaped his thinking And as you do that, looking back, you may want to reframe the question. I don't know, but I'm gonna invite you to go back and take a look at how Obama talks about how he was how he got to this place of believing as he does, and I think you follow my drift.
You know, the caller will allow us perhaps to shift our conversation. Mm-hmm. Part of your memoir is certainly a personal narrative in terms of your own development and how you became who you are, but also as a public servant. And you mentioned in terms of public policy, you were, I'm not sure what the word to use, you were drawn, led to directed, called even.
Called even, yes.
Into serving the public in various ways throughout your career. And in your memoirs, you talk about it from schooling, your early work with public agencies here, and then working with the state. As you look back on your life and your public career, do you see it as, looking back now, as inevitable? Were there certain, you mentioned certain various points in your life where you, mm-hmm. there's certainly a calling with people in the community, for example, when you first ran for, appointed for the legislature, sort of like called you and said, mm-hmm. we want you, Avell. Mm-hmm. Looking back, do you see it as a trajectory that it was inevitable? Were there certain points that...
Defining moments. The first defining moment that comes to mind that set me on this, and I'm going to borrow your word, trajectory. I haven't had my first cup of coffee yet this morning. Would be when I was a teenager. I was a student at Girls Polytechnic High School, and here in Portland, no longer exists. Student body of roughly 500. In my graduating class, there may have been 20 black women. One year, and this was the year that the four little girls were bombed to death, killed, massacred.
In Birmingham.
Such a terrible, terrible, terrible deaths. Again, four little girls. And we had here in Portland a march and protest. And I remember being informed about this march and protest by one of my teachers at the time, Mr. Gilman, Amasa Gilman. And I believe he's still living. And it was Mr. Gilman who encouraged me and some of my other sister friends to come out and participate in this march, which we did. And the gathering took place at Vancouver Avenue Baptist Church. And then we marched from there to downtown Portland. That was a defining moment as a teenager and hearing others raise their voices and also using mine, and at the same time being very conscious that what we were protesting was something so terrible. It was about the loss of life and the loss of children, girls, in this civil rights struggle, which had been unfolding before us on television. You know, we'd been watching and reading and knew about the events in that way, but it became very personal, very personal. I'm going to fast forward to the Watergate era when Barbara Jordan, Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, was serving. And I remember watching television and hearing her mighty voice and that powerful enunciation making a point about all that was wrong with the way in which power was being used by Nixon and his administration. I can't repeat her exact words, but I just remember the voice. It was the voice, it was the tone, it was the authority in the tone, and just the certainty, and the principles through which she was speaking that really, really captured me. And then later, I would graduate from Portland State University in the summer of 74, on the same day that Richard Nixon resigned from office. So, seeds planted? Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. I think there were some seeds planted. And also, again, remember, I witnessed my mother, my grandmothers, all being very active, having very active roles in community. My grandmother, Alberta, and Mrs. Bobby Gary, the late Mrs. Bobby Gary, both co-chaired an event, not an event, but effort in the Albina community back in 1959 that was called the Tuberculosis Trackdown, TB Trackdown. And at that time, there was a huge health problem around tuberculosis and in the black community. And so there was an effort to get people tested and make sure that people got the treatment they needed at the time. And my grandmother and Mrs. Bobby Gary both, again, co-chaired this TB trackdown. And I have a picture of both of them that was taken by an Oregonian reporter and complete with a story that appeared in the Oregonian in 1959. I keep that in my office as a reminder that I'm standing on their shoulders. And it was interesting back in, I think it was 99 or 2000, when Governor Kitzhaber asked me to co-chair the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. I remember looking again at that picture of my grandmother and Mrs. Gary and saying, okay, you all poured it in. That's, you know, that's
how this, some more.
That's why this is happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you're in the Columbia River area, in the Willamette Valley, 100.7, and on the web, it's KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott and myself, Celeste Carey. We are speaking with Avell Louise Gordley and talking about her recently published memoir, Remembering the Power of Words, the Life of an Oregon Activist, Legislator, and Community Leader. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the phone number is 503-231-8187. To speak with Avell Gordley about some of the key aspects of her life and her community and political contributions. We'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Joanne.
Yes, hello. Some years back, a lot of people were talking about this phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. Do any of you think we can honestly create that in this war culture? And also, for some reason, I'm thinking of Cynthia McKinney and feeling her energy has been squashed. And also, I'm being polite. I'm very angry at Mr. Obama, Mrs. Clinton, all the warmongers. But in the meantime, thanks for the program.
Thank you very much for your question. And just to pick up on your the quote, the African proverb. The proverb says, it takes a whole village to raise a child. It takes a whole village to raise a child. And the emphasis, I place the emphasis on the word whole. Whole meaning all the people, but whole also meaning healthy. Healthy physically, emotionally, whole in all the positive meanings of that word. Yes, it is possible to build beloved community that is whole. That's our work. That's our work to do together while we're here. And it's so important that we all claim our piece of doing that in each and every day and not give in or give over to a sense of hopelessness or, you know, those feelings that can come when everything just seems so big and huge and, you know.
And wrong.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. In each and every day, in each and every moment, we have the opportunity to say something or do something that is positive, that is uplifting, that's going to help somebody else. And if we just keep it real simple in that way, then I think it gives us something to build on. But I would just say, when we use that phrase, let's just remember where it came from. It's an African proverb, and place the emphasis on the village. On the character of the village must be whole. It takes a whole village to raise a child. It's not just a village. It's got to be a whole village, a village that is all that's inclusive of all the people who live in it, and whole, healthy people who have the capacity to unleash all that is good and positive and meaningful in building up and lifting up beloved community.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, the phone number is 503-231-8187. We'll go to our next caller.
Herschel.
Good morning, Herschel.
Good morning. Yeah, first of all, I mean, Mike called in there and he asked a question of Abel, and I thought it was a bit arrogant of her to kind of, rather than answer a question, just tell this guy to go read a book. I mean, how arrogant can you get? The question is, how was she able to support Gordon Smith, a Republican who has no interest in helping black people, working people? He's kind of right down the line. He supports the wealthy in there and efforts around the world. How was she able to do that and justify it?
I had the privilege of working with former Senator Gordon Smith when he was a member of the Oregon legislature. He was serving in the Senate at the same time I was serving in the House. And I had the assignment of being the liaison from our House caucus to his Senate caucus. And so I had the opportunity to meet with him on a regular basis and through those meetings got to know him. And fast forward, over time, I came to appreciate his support for mental health and for fighting for mental health parity, fighting for funding for mental health. I came to appreciate his support for gay and lesbian issues and people in our community. And it was around issues, some particular issues, that I found my way to supporting his candidacy. And I also felt then and now that it was important to have representation in our congressional delegation that comes from more than just one area of the state, not just all representing the Willamette Valley the liberal thought, but to have a congressional delegation that is representative of as broad a representation of our state as possible, and particularly rural Oregon. And I came to understand that importance as a member of the legislature, looking at the needs of the entire state and not just one party or one corner of the state's interest.
Avia, I'd mm-hmm. like to pop in really quickly mm-hmm. and bring out something that you mentioned in your book. And that was a deliberate effort on your part to talk to both sides of the aisle,
yes,
as well as all aspects of the community. Mm-hmm. So when you ran for the appointment, or rather you lobbied, or this is the word I want, campaigned,
mm-hmm,
and got out to meet people for the appointment as well as the election when you're running, you made a point of saying, I tried to talk to everybody.
Exactly.
To make sure that everybody knew who I was. So, you know, to address an implicit statement by the caller, it's as though you should play partisan politics. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, no, that's not my issue.
And also, could you address, because I think an important point you raise in this book in terms of your development is your critique on politics, mm-hmm, electoral politics, as mm-hmm, it's done in this state, mm-hmm, and in terms of, I think you might have used the term nepotism.
Nepotism.
I'm not sure whether I
yes.
use
oh,
it.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Mm-hmm. There's so much to say there. Well, first of all, I am not a product of party politics. Mm-hmm. And I was a registered independent right up until the time that Jesse Jackson ran for president in the 80s. And in order to support his candidacy and to work for him in Oregon through the very active Rainbow Coalition at that time, in order to support his candidacy, to be able to vote for him, I switched from independent to D, small D. And again, mm-hmm, not through activism in the Democrat Party. And so my roots have always been independent, and I have to remind people of that. What I experienced through my 17 years of service in the legislature is that we have allowed partisan politics to become so toxic that it inhibits our opportunities to grow and develop our state. And I guess the best example I can draw on would be our failure to address revenue reform in the state. That would be one huge example, revenue reform. We have a system of gathering revenue that was framed in the 20th century to meet 20th century needs. And we have a constitutional mandate that is has been ignored, a constitutional mandate that says when there's insufficient funds to operate government services, the legislature shall levy a tax. Now, that language is captured in the Constitution. I think it's Article 9. It is Article 9, the section on finance. And then there's specific language in Sections 2 and 6, which talk about the insufficiency of funds and the necessity of levying a tax. That language, the language that's in the Constitution, I believe was placed there anticipating the time would come when legislators would need to make an adjustment in the system of revenue gathering in order to meet the needs of the people of the state. That is a constitutional mandate that the legislature continues to run from. It doesn't matter who's in charge, whether it's Democrats or the Republicans, no one touches that particular mandate. What you'll hear legislators do instead is talk about the constitutional mandate to balance a budget.
Right.
Certainly, that is a mandate. But there's this other piece, too, that's just as important, if not more important, because it's about planning. It's about planning for the growth and development of the state. And so until or unless we get people who are willing to address that piece, that constitutional piece, we're gonna be stuck. We're gonna stay stuck.
We're gonna keep repeating the same
mistake. The same cycle.
We're gonna go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Yeah, you guys had mentioned the freeway and the Coliseum as a couple of reasons that the black community was dismantled, but I want to throw in a third factor, which basically was one of the nails in our coffin. That's the Portland Police Precinct that they put in Northeast Portland. And the reason they put that police precinct over there is they wanted to remove some of the elements in the black community that white folks was fearful of, which was an impediment to gentrification. So they put the police precinct over there to lock up the black youth and such and such and such. Also, back in the 60s and the 70s, the black community was a closed community. White folks were scared to even come through there. They used to just drive through there, but they wouldn't park over there and hang out too long. That's when the black community was militant. That's when the black community was political. But something happened. The black community wanted to assimilate. And so back in the day, the vanguard was the religious community. They were activists. Now the religious community are capitalists. And basically what they want to do is exploit the members, the community. They're not out there on the front lines no more. They have went somewhere else in their thinking. So that's what I've seen take place in the black community. Mm-hmm. Talk to you later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, your roots in terms of your activism is certainly in the black community, and I would it be legitimate to say in terms of black power movement, cultural, political black power movement?
I spent a number of years working actively with the National Black United Front and our Portland chapter. And at one point in my service with the Front, I served as vice chair for international affairs with the national organization. And as you probably remember, Cecil, the local Front chapter was very aggressive in the way in which we moved on police reform, on because we were dealing with some terrible examples of police brutality. We were very aggressive in the way in which we moved on education reform. There, our emphasis was on a quality, non-racist education for all children, not just black children, all children. And we also had an economic arm. You know, it was through the Black United Front, and particularly through the leadership of Ronnie Herndon and Reverend John Jackson, that we were able to get Nike to agree to place a store on King Boulevard, and that was an effort to start some revitalization.
Provide jobs, job training.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Jobs and job training. That was one of our goals, MET goals, was to hire from the neighborhood. And so my roots around activism as it relates to lifting up the black community, a lot of that activism was seen through my work with the Black United Front, and then later with the Urban League of Portland.
We've got two more callers and not a lot of time, so we'll see if we can squeeze them in. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I just wanted to call and thank Avelle for her work around mental health and gay issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Short and sweet.
Could you share something about those?
Well, I'm very proud of the work that has been led by the Reverend Dr. W.G. Hardy Jr., who chairs the African American Mental Health Commission. And through the work of that commission over the past 12 years or so, we have been able to establish in downtown Portland, in collaboration with the Oregon Health and Science University, the A.V.L. Gordley Center for Healing, which is located at 621 Southwest Alder on the fifth floor. And this is a multicultural mental health center responsive to the needs of diverse communities in Oregon. And we are very proud of the complement of culturally specific practitioners we have on board to serve the needs of the community. Danette Birchall is a clinical associate director, is actually the clinical director of the Center for Healing. And the clinic opened up on, the center opened up in February of 2008, so we're well into our third year of providing services. We remain challenged around funding because our funds come through the state and also through the county, so that will be a struggle. But it is my belief, strong belief, that these services are going to remain in our community, and they'll remain in that location. I think that Oregon Health Science University has come to understand that through the provision of these services, they, in fact, are now seen as a more relevant provider of health services in our community.
And taking important steps to creating that village that you mentioned earlier that had the health and integrity.
Exactly.
And I mean integrity in terms of honesty as well as wholeness to,
yes,
to help everybody move forward. We have one more caller. We got like
60 seconds.
Okay, good morning. You're on the air, Rod.
Hi, Avril. This is Dr. Rod Alexander, Reverend Dr. Rod Alexander. You and I met many years ago when I became the first executive director of the Albina Ministerial Alliance, working along with the Reverend John Garlington, the late Reverend John Garlington.
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back a little while. But I remember you. I remember your efforts then. I have followed you over the years. I've lived in and out of the state since then. But I certainly want to encourage you to continue on, ongoing with all that you have before you yet. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You probably don't remember me, but I worked with Cornelia.
Yes, I do.
Those days, and sometime I remember the history from the 80s that you were cataloging also.
Okay, well, we're out of time,
okay,
but
well,
we thank you for your calling.
Cross again. I hope you will give the folks some way to contact you.
Portland State University Black Studies Department, Portland State University.
We want to thank our guest this morning, Senator A.V.L. Gordley, who is the author of Remembering the Power of Words, her personal memoir, a memoir of a community. And we thank you for all you are doing. And we just touch upon a little bit.
We just touched upon a little bit. We'll have to have you come back, maybe even co-host with us.
I would love to.
This has been More Talk Radio on your community connection, KBOO Portland. We're going to go out with a little Fela, both in homage to A.V.L. Louise Gordley and into Jean-Paul Aristide and to all of the struggles of the world.